From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, comic, actor, and novelist Steve Martin. His new novel, The Pleasure of My Company, is about a man who is so neurotic and obsessive he rarely ventures out of his apartment, but he enters the essay contest, Why I Am an Average American. We'll talk with Martin about writing, acting, and comedy, and he'll read from The Pleasure of My Company. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the rhetoric of colorblindness and the racial privacy initiative on tomorrow's California ballot that would restrict the state's ability to classify people according to race. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Candidates in California's recall election are on their final day of campaigning. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco reports from Los Angeles.
Governor Gray Davis began his final day of campaigning with elementary and high school students in Sacramento, most of them too young to vote, where he talked about spending more money on education. Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger found his way to San Jose today, where he was flanked by women supporters. He made no mention of allegations that he groped and verbally harassed 15 women over the past three decades. Meanwhile, rallying in East LA, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante said the allegations mean that his rival is not fit to be governor. Another frontrunner, Republican State Senator Tom McClintock, was not as harsh in his criticism today, telling reporters that he is still skeptical about the timing of the allegations. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
President Bush cautioned Israel today not to take steps to make the current tensions in the Middle East worse, but he did not criticize an Israeli airstrike in Syria. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president chose his words very carefully, saying he spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Sharon to express his condolences in the wake of a weekend suicide bomb attack that killed 19 people in the city of Haifa. Mr. Bush said he told Sharon that Israel does have a right to defend itself.
However, I said that it's very important that any action Israel take should avoid escalation and creating higher tensions.
Mr. Bush did not say if he agreed with Israel's belief that the location targeted in Syria was the home of a terrorist training camp. The president said the U.S.-backed roadmap for Middle East peace is still the best approach and said he still supports the creation of an independent Palestinian state. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
As Congress debates the Bush administration's $20 billion request for the reconstruction of Iraq, five senators made a two-day visit to Baghdad. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican who heads the group, said in Baghdad that it would be a mistake to turn some of the money from a gift to a loan.
If the United States were to make this in the form of a loan, it would confirm the worst suspicions of some of the elements still in Iraq that believe that we came here for some other reason than to liberate this country.
McConnell also confirmed that the classified part of the president's budget request for Iraq calls for spending about $600 million to keep up the so far unsuccessful search for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. The president's total request for Iraq and Afghanistan comes to $87 billion. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 22 points to close at 9,595. The NASDAQ gained 13 points. It closed at 1,893. This is NPR News. This year's Nobel Prize in Medicine goes to two scientists who developed magnetic resonance imaging. MRI machines have transformed medical diagnosis over the past two decades. NPR's Richard Knox reports.
Paul Lauterbur of the University of Illinois and Peter Mansfield at the University of Nottingham in England will split the $1.2 million prize. They took a 1940s technique for analyzing chemical samples and showed it could be used to make startling pictures of the inside of the human body. Today, MRI is indispensable for diagnosing a wide range of ailments, from brain cancer and multiple sclerosis to heart disease and knee injuries. Many thought the Nobel Committee might recognize the inventors of MRI years ago, but Lauterbur says he didn't expect the call from Stockholm.
This was very much a surprise. I did not go to sleep expecting to be awakened at 4 in the morning.
Lauterbur, who is in his mid-70s, still goes to the lab 7 days a week. Richard Knox, NPR News.
U.S. military officials in Iraq have reinstated a police chief they removed 5 months ago. The move came after a weekend of rioting in which pro-Saddam Hussein demonstrators drove the 300-member U.S.-backed Iraqi police force out of the oil-refining city of Beji. The rioting reportedly began when a policeman tore up a picture of ousted Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Before it was over, the police force fled the city and U.S. troops from the 4th Infantry Division had to move in to fight the demonstrators, who were armed with mortars, grenades, and automatic rifles. The former police chief met with local tribal chiefs shortly after he was reinstated, saying that he would consider their demands. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the great actor and comic Steve Martin, the star of such films as The Jerk, All of Me, Roxanne, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, L.A. Story, Father of the Bride, The Spanish Prisoner, Bowfinger, and Bringing Down the House. Steve Martin has also established himself as a novelist. Shopgirl, the novel he published 3 years ago, was a bestseller. He's now adapting it into a film. He has a new novel called The Pleasure of My Company, and if you're thinking it's a wild and crazy guy kind of story, it's not, but it is witty. It's about Daniel Pecan Cambridge, a man who has so many neurotic fears and compulsions that he seldom dares to leave his Santa Monica apartment. I asked Steve Martin to start with a short reading from The Pleasure of My Company.
This all started because of a clerical error. Without the clerical error, I wouldn't have been thinking this way at all. I wouldn't have had time. I would have been too preoccupied with my new friends I was planning to make at Mensa, the International Society of Geniuses. I'd taken their IQ test, but my score came back missing a digit. Where was the one that should have been in front of the 90? I fell short of the genius category by a full 50 points, barely enough to qualify me to sharpen their pencils. Thus, I was rejected from membership and facing a hopeless pile of red tape to correct the mistake. Santa Monica, California, where I live, is a perfect town for invalids, homosexuals, show people, and all other formerly peripheral members of society. Average is not the norm here. Here, if you're visiting from Omaha, you stick out like a senorita's ass at the Puerto Rican Day parade. That's why, when I saw a contest at the Rite Aid drugstore asking for a 2-page essay on why I am the most average American, I marveled that the promoters actually thought they might find an average American at this nut house by the beach. This cardboard stand carried an ad by its sponsor, Tepperton's Frozen Apple Pies. I grabbed an entry form, and as I hurried home, began composing the essay in my head. The challenge was not to present myself as average, but how to make myself likable without lying. I think I'm appealing, but likability in an essay is very different from likability in life. See, I tend to grow on people, and 500 words is just not enough to get someone to like me. I need several years and a ream or two of paper. I knew I had to flatter, overdo, and lay it on thick in order to speed up my likability time frame. So I would not like the sniveling, patriotic me who wrote my 500 words. I would like a girl with dark roots peeking out through the peroxide who was laughing so hard that Coca-Cola was coming out of her nose. And I guess you would, too. But Miss Coca-Cola Nose wouldn't be writing this essay in her Coca-Cola persona. She would straighten up, fix her hair, snap her panties out of her ass, and start typing. I am average because, I wrote, I stand on the seashore here in Santa Monica and let the Pacific Ocean touch my toes, and I know I am at the most western edge of our nation, and that I am a descendant of the settlers who came to California as pioneers. And is not every American a pioneer? Does this spirit not reside in each one of us, in every city, in every heart, on every rural road, in every traveler, in every Winnebago, in every American living, in every mansion or slum? I am average, I wrote, because the cry of individuality flows confidently through my blood with little attention drawn to itself, like the still power of an apple pie sitting in an open window to cool. I hope the Mensa people never see this essay, not because it reeks of my manipulation of a poor company just trying to sell pies, but because, during the 24 hours it took me to write it, I believed so fervently in its every word.
Thank you. That's Steve Martin reading from his new novel, The Pleasure of My Company. Well, your character, although he's writing this essay on why he's the most average American, is very not average, wouldn't you say?
Very not. He's a very icy. He's a young man in his early 30s. He's unclear in the book about his real age, which he doesn't reveal until the last couple of pages for a reason you'll find out later. And he's isolated. He's a kind of a benign neurotic. He has certain rituals. He can't cross the street at the curb. He has to find two opposing scooped-out driveways. He has to keep the wattage in his apartment constant at 1,125 watts. For example, if he turns out a light in his bedroom, he must turn on a light in the living room or kitchen. And it's only a three-room house. And this is a story of how his life opens up, finally opens up, as he is, describes himself, that he has narrowed his life down to keep everything out. In fact, his stated goal was to have so many rules and conditions that he could control everything that was coming into him, and then he would slowly open the doors one at a time.
Now, your character wants to get into Mensa, and he thinks they made some kind of clerical error, leaving off the number one before his 90. You also wrote a piece for The New Yorker about Mensa.
Yes. As I say, there was a precursor to this.
Right, right.
And I think that I needed to start that way in order to kind of go back to that essay, revisit that character in my head, and kick it off from where I left it off before.
What does Mensa mean to you? I mean, it's this group of people with high IQs get
right.
together.
I always saw it in this way. Okay, well, you might have a high IQ, but what have you done lately? And I think the real stroke of genius is in what you do and not in some score.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it a little bit cynically. I have no cynicism toward any Mensa member, but it was just the way I looked at the world, that the accomplishments are what matters and not scores.
Steve Martin is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Pleasure of My Company. I'd be interested in hearing why you want your writing to be writing for the page as opposed to writing for the screen.
Well, I started writing in 1965, when I wrote little essays in college that later became a book I published called Cruel Shoes. And then I was writing for my comedy act throughout the 60s and 70s. And then in the late 70s, I started writing screenplays, co-writing them with, other writers, The Jerk and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Of course, right, right.
And then in the late, mid-80s, I started writing solo screenplays, Roxanne and L.A. Story and Simple Twist of Fate. And then I really have written a lot of screenplays, Bowfinger, too. And then in the early 90s, I really got a call from the New York Times asking me to write something on this. There was a discovery of a Michelangelo statue here in New York City. So I wrote a little parody of that and went into The New Yorker ultimately. Actually, the truth is I really enjoy writing for the page because it's an utterly different thing. You know, a screenplay is description and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And a book is really about sentences and paragraphs and their structure and their rhythm and the use of words, the exact, precise use of words. You know, in a screenplay can be, you know, I remember one year I saw a little list in a magazine of, you know, the best lines from the movies this year. And they were all like, come on, let's get out of here.
Like catchphrases.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's just a very different, what your best line in a movie is very different from a best line in a book. So it's a completely different enterprise.
You know, as an actor, particularly early in your career, your persona was usually very extroverted. As a writer, like your two novels are about really introverted characters. I think that's an interesting contrast.
Well, I think actually that without, you know, being too boring, analyzing my sort of stage act, that character, sorry to talk about that in that way, but he was a bit crazy. He was a little, I was on stage. This, very similar to this character, really. It's like on stage, I was really just expressing a perverse thought
on the way the world worked. And I remember this one bit I did was that I was, I was so mad at my mother. I used to scream it, of course, because she wanted to borrow $10 for some food. And, you know, there's some kind of link here between this character who just sees things in the odd way.
All writers talk about, you know, facing the blank page and so on, but it really is true that the difference between being an actor and being on the set and being, you know, working with other people is so different than staying at home and writing.
Right.
Do you like that more isolated process of writing?
Well, you know, they complement each other so well because, like you say, movies are active and social and physical, and writing is solitary and personal. And I never wanted to be an actor who sat home and waited for scripts to come through the door. I mean, I just, it'd drive me insane, waiting and hoping. So I always wrote and I always did comedy, and I just liked, I like the activity of it. You know, I just find that when I'm idle, which I always enjoy, I always find that something comes up, something pops up. So I'll get out the computer and start typing.
Do you think you approach writing with a different personality than the one you approach acting with?
I would have to say yes, because, you know, it's just so different. They are completely different. But I really think that my acting has influenced my writing, because as an actor, you finally, as you get a little better at it, you realize you're observing character. And you realize that it's the details that make character. It's the little tiny actions. And so in writing, I think I realize, or at least I like, to pick up those details that determine character.
And those are the same kinds of things you have to pick up when you're acting, too, aren't they? I mean, you're not
describing
them, you're doing them. Yeah, yeah.
Right. It's from acting. But the strange thing about acting is it's also what you don't do. I mean, it's almost a thought process in your head that is so expressive. So the more you can detail it in your mind, and without, you know, what we call in acting indicating an emotion. I remember once the director, Herb Ross, he was mad at an actress. And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Well, she's supposed to be mad. She's supposed to be mad." And I said, "Well, she's yelling." And he says, "Yes, but anger has 1,000 faces." And I always remembered that. It's like, oh, yes, some of the angriest moments I've ever felt are when I did nothing or said nothing and expressed nothing.
Right.
So there's always those choices in behavior.
My guest is Steve Martin. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Martin is my guest, and he's just published his second novel. It's called The Pleasure of My Company, and his first novel, Shop Girl, is being adapted into a film. You know, I think it's hard when you're so accomplished at something to try something that you're new to, as you were new to writing novels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, when you're at the top of your profession in one thing, and then you're brand new to something else, you can fail, you can be flawed, and you can be very insecure. You have no track record. So did starting to write bring out insecurities that you weren't used to because...
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But there's a trick when you first start writing.
Teach it to me, please.
Well, you don't have to show it to anybody.
Right.
when you're sitting there alone and you haven't, you know, made a deal with somebody to deliver a book, mm-hmm. you're really on your own. And you can, it's like putting your toe in the water. You can have written something and you give it to a friend or you ask someone's opinion. So it never has, you always fooled yourself because, you know, and the reason I say you fool yourself, ultimately you do want it to be out there. But you fool yourself by saying, it doesn't matter. I can be lousy. No one will ever see it if it's lousy. And, of course, they do see it, and sometimes it's lousy.
So you would agree that self-delusion is an important part of writing.
Very, very important. I really do. I think it is. It's like, I remember the first night I previewed my play, Picasso at the La Panagile. I'd never written a play. I'd written screenplays, but I was in Melbourne, Australia, and now it's 10 minutes before curtain, and all I could think is, what have I done? I didn't know if there's going to be a laugh, anything. It was just, it could have been so humiliating. But then only, 40 people would have seen it, and I could have gone home with my tail between my legs. But I just like to add that I really don't have a tail.
Do you write many drafts before publishing?
What I do is I write without inhibiting myself, and then I will, a draft is not quite the right word in my head. I go through and I start editing, and I start reading it, and I start reading it over and over and over, which can get very tiresome. So sometimes I'll put it down for 3 months, come back, read it again, then I'll read it aloud to myself,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll read it to my dog. And I find that reading it aloud makes you catch every word. And to me, every word is important because I'm a reader who gets bored quickly. So I need to have these sentences on the move and be interesting all the time. So I try to catch everything.
Is your dog helpful when you're reading to him?
Well, he's my audience. I'm not looking for his response.
You just need somebody to read to.
Yeah.
Did you feel an obligation to be funny when you started writing? Because that's what people expect of you.
Well, no. Because the first book, Shop Girl, although it has funny moments, I wouldn't call it a funny book.
Right.
But in Pleasure of My Company, I actually wanted the book to be funny. And I knew that I had a character who could be funny. And I, it's really, whenever I start even a New Yorker essay, I have the idea, I think, okay, what is the potential of this? I have no idea what the individual bits will be or moments or anything, but does it seem rich or does it seem I'm going to run out of steam in a couple of paragraphs? And I felt with this character, he could really keep going. And it's a cliche to talk about the discovery of character as you keep writing, but I found that my mind retains little details of things I've written 40 or 50 pages ago. And so something that you wrote that was very, very casual, a little aside, a little something he did, comes back at a certain moment and it becomes big. Because now this tiny little thing impacts something else. And it's like this, it's like weaving a web or weaving a something else, a caftan. I don't know which I'm weaving. But that's what I really like, is where the details start to add up.
Well, you've had your success in the book world and the film world, and you've been on the bestseller list, and you're probably the only person to have hosted both the Academy Awards and the National Book Awards.
I guess I am.
Yeah, I think so.
I'll have to stop any Oscar host from hosting the National Book Awards so I can keep my uniqueness.
So, I think that would probably give you a good seat as to some of the differences between the two worlds, the film world and the book world.
Well, the differences, the book world is much, much slower
mm-hmm.
than the film world. I mean, the film world is so oriented to promotion and getting the word out in certain ways, getting the word out in very vibrant ways and very specific soundbite ways. And for example, I mean, here I am talking to you for 40 minutes about my book. This would never happen about a film. I mean, in terms of the way a film is generally promoted, but it's the way books are promoted. They're talked about in depth in much slower ways.
Well, and the numbers are so much smaller too, aren't they?
Right.
Like a
right.
best-selling book probably doesn't come close to the ticket sales of a mediocre-selling movie.
Probably, yeah. But you know what I found is that when I started writing for The New Yorker, I noticed I got more reaction from one essay, and I'm talking about actual reaction that I could feel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people saying things, than I did for movies, like entire movies that cost millions and millions of dollars to come out, and I would hear, you know, very little, or somebody would say, nice movie or something. But these essays, they started to, I guess it's because they're so intimate with the reader, they're so intimately involved that it stays with them longer. You know, a movie, sometimes I walk out, I've forgotten it, you know, as I'm exiting the lobby.
Steve Martin, his new novel is called The Pleasure of My Company. Here's a scene from the film Bowfinger, which he wrote and directed. Martin plays a would-be director who has a movie script he believes is finally his ticket to success. So when Kit Ramsey, the big star he needs for the film, refuses to even read it, Martin lies to his cast and crew, telling them Ramsey is on board. Here he is explaining his plan to his cameraman, played by Jamie Kennedy.
You told him we're going to make this movie?
That's right, I did. That's what I did.
So you're going to have to tell him.
Tell him what?
That we're not going to make the movie.
What do you mean we're not making the movie? Dave, I made them a promise.
But how are you going to make the movie with Kit Ramsey? He said no.
You don't think I thought about that? You don't think I worked that out? We are making this movie with Kit Ramsey, except...
Except what?
Except he won't know he's in it.
What?
We secretly follow him around with a camera. We have our actors walk up to him and say their lines. And he's in our movie. And we don't have to pay him.
What's he gonna say?
What difference does it make what he says? It's an action movie. All he's gotta do is run. He runs away from the aliens. He runs toward the aliens. He runs away from the aliens. Come here, I wanna show you something. Got this all worked out, I think. There are six major scenes with Kit. Those are the ones in red. He's not in any of the other scenes, so we just shoot those with our own actors on our own time, and bingo, we've got a movie.
Steve Martin in Bowfinger. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the University of Nebraska Press, publishers of Phantom Limb by Janet Sternberg, a memoir of an adult daughter confronting ghosts of the past during her parents' last years, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Steve Martin. And on the eve of the California recall, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers an item on the ballot that nobody seems to be talking about.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic, actor, director, and writer Steve Martin. His many films include The Jerk, All of Me, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Parenthood, Father of the Bride, The Spanish Prisoner, Bowfinger, and Bringing Down the House. He's also the author of the best-selling novel, Shop Girl. Now he has a new novel called The Pleasure of My Company. He's also written numerous essays for The New Yorker. Well, I'd like to mention an essay of yours that I particularly liked, and it was a personal essay about your late father.
Yes.
And, it was about how he had wanted to act and had done some amateur acting when he was young, and how you had, you know, kind of rocky relationship. And, well, one of the things you talk about is how you decided to take your parents out to lunches every Sunday so that you could get to mm-hmm. know them better. Mm-hmm. And you realized mm-hmm. that they were bickering all the time when you took them out to lunch, so
they weren't getting anywhere. Right.
And then
they were contradicting each other, so I decided one time to take them out alone, each, you know, one at a time.
And that
and
worked.
Without the other person there, I could get stories and, anecdotes and opinions and attitudes that I never would have gotten if they'd been there together.
I thought that was so smart to think of that. And then you also wrote about how your father, when he was basically on his deathbed, said to you, mm-hmm. you did everything I wanted to do.
Right.
I thought, wow, that's what a zinger for.
Well, it's quite a moment, really.
Yeah. Did you ask yourself whether he would think it was okay to say that, you know, to write that? I guess one of the questions I'm asking is, do you think the standard does or should change when someone is no longer with us about what's too private to say about them? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I did not feel that that was too personal.
Uh-huh.
I was very particular about what I said. In fact, I ran the essay by my sister to get her opinions on anything that might be too personal. But I didn't feel that was too personal because he was really demonstrating kindness there at that moment.
Because he'd been so critical comparatively in the
right.
past
mm-hmm.
of you.
Yeah.
Right. You haven't written a lot of personal stuff. Most of your writing is fiction or humor. And there's something that you wrote in an essay in the New York Times that really meant a lot to me. I mean, I wrote it down and stuck it on my computer so I could refer to it. I've mentioned it in a talk. And this was in the context of talking about why you decided to have a show of art from your art collection, something you used to be very, very private mm-hmm. about. And you said, being a celebrity can cause an accidental cheapening of the things one holds dear. A slip of the tongue in an interview, and it's easy for me to feel I've sold out some private part of my life in exchange for publicity. Mm-hmm. I really thought that was so well put, and I'm in the position, you know, of asking the questions usually, mm-hmm. And I know that that's always a possibility. Do you know what I mean? That both the interviewer and the interviewee risk cheapening things. At the same time, I don't want that to happen. That's like the unintentional mm-hmm. occasional result. But you know, I think you're trying both ends to be really sensitive to that. But I thought you just put it so well.
Well, I think, you know, the problem with, you know, being interviewed as a celebrity is that, for example, you and I are talking now. We're talking on NPR, and it's a very special circumstance. It's much more detailed. It can be way more personal than, say, I would be on Entertainment Tonight. And I'm willing, much more willing to talk about private things in this circumstance. But what happens is this I might pay for 3 years from now in an interview on Entertainment Tonight, because they will bring up something, maybe something I said that's personal. Now, actually, that's kind of diminished because, you know, I'm at a nice stage of my career where, you know, I can get around and there's no sort of, you know, crazy invasion of privacy and I also learn to keep relationships to myself, because I realize I realized this a long time ago, that kind of focus on your personal life actually damages it.
You know, at the same time, I'm sure when you're doing an interview, even if you just see it as a promotional interview, you want to be as interesting as possible. So then, again, there's the kind of trade-off between, well, this will make it more interesting. On the other hand, it's personal. I just assume not talk about it. So does that equation play out in your mind?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, because there's almost no way for me to make an interview about a movie interesting. I realize that. You know, I listened to Howard Stern, and he always plays celebrities' interviews, and we all just sound ridiculous. And I know that as I'm giving these interviews, I am that person that will be mocked because there's just, you know, it's just not ultimately that interesting, you know. So you have to kind of make up things. And, you know, it's just a funny business. It's like the worst day of your life, you know, when you have to go talk about the movie you've made.
Oh, you're making me feel terrible.
Pardon me?
You're making me feel terrible.
No, it's not you. I'm talking about the soundbite industry.
Uh-huh. Do you get obsessive about things where you really, once you get into it, you're into it?
Yes. But I think there's other terms for that.
Devoted.
Well, I remember an article in the New York Times years ago called In the Zone. And he talked about when for example, when a basketball player is hot and he's just sinking these baskets one after another. And they talked about people who are in the zone losing consciousness of time. We've probably all been stuck with a computer problem and you looked and suddenly 4 hours have gone by while you're trying to solve it. And that to me is what writing is. It just is so absorbing that time goes by. Time goes by quickly or it stops.
Yeah, but the problem is with writing, if time goes by quickly and you don't like what you've written in that time, you feel like you've lost something. Maybe that doesn't happen to you.
Well, you know, I don't write unless I'm ready.
Uh-huh.
So usually, I find if you're in the zone, you usually like what you've written. And if I'm not in the zone, I generally don't write.
Right.
I will edit at that point using what we'll call the monkey mind.
What do you mean?
Somebody gave that to me years ago. It was like the monkey mind was you know, there was your creative mind, and then there was your monkey mind, and your monkey mind was really consciousness. You know, and the monkey mind should do the editing. It's the one that's not original. It's the one that's imitative. And that's just a term for doing the slave work of writing.
Boy, the editor community is going to be very angry at that description.
No, I rely heavily on editors. I really need response.
My guest is actor, comic, and writer Steve Martin. His new novel is called The Pleasure of My Company. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Steve Martin is my guest. His new novel is called The Pleasure of My Company. Martin has starred in many films, including the 1998 David Mamet movie, The Spanish Prisoner. Here's a scene from it. Martin plays Jimmy Dell, an apparently charming and wealthy man who befriends Joe Ross, played by Campbell Scott. Here, Jimmy is giving Joe business advice.
You know what the man said about verbal agreements? They're not worth the paper they're printed on.
That's what my boss just said to me.
Henry what? I mean, what is he? What's he talking about?
Well, I've got a. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I did something for the company, and they owe me something. I think I need to get it in writing.
I would. What do they owe you?
I think they owe me a lot of money.
What do you mean you think?
I invented something for them. It's a work for hire. They own it, but.
Hello, is Mrs. DeSilva in?
Who told you it was a work for hire? Well, they did.
You invented it?
Well, I.
I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a guy. Tell me, you invented it?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Spanish Prisoner was written and directed by David Mamet.
Yes, absolutely.
Must have been a pleasure to to read his dialogue.
Fabulous. I love doing it. You know, his dialogue is a challenge for an actor because it's incredibly precise, including the ers and uhs and the way we speak, going back, retracing our words, just like I just did, or like I just did. And so it's kind of it's really fun to do that because you really have to, you cannot, as you're speaking the dialogue, you can't get ahead of yourself. You have to actually forget at that moment what you're going to say next.
What do you mean that you have to forget it?
Well, in other words, if it's written that there's a hesitation or an er and an ah, if you come up to it and you're prepared for it, it's going to sound like er.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very dead. So you have to talk as though you know what you're going to say, but you don't. You have to forget what you're going to say at that moment.
And then you have to remember it again.
Yeah, well, it's acting. I mean, you know what it is. But, you know.
So do you feel like you learned any new things from working with Mamet?
Yeah, but it's you know, he was a really good director for me because he kept reminding me. You know, my character was supposed to be very wealthy and very confident. And he kept reminding me of what that is, which is nothing gets to you. No mm-hmm. one can get to you. And that was a great reminder. And it really provided me in the film with this kind of stillness and, you know, ease with everything.
I sometimes think about what it must have been like for you and Ricky Jay, who was also in The Spanish Prisoner, to work together, because he used to be used to do magic, and Ricky Jay is, you know, one of the
right.
great
well,
living
Jay,
yeah. prestidigitators, is that?
Yes, yes.
And you know, master of card tricks and cons and the lore of magic and carnivals. And so
Ricky Jay and I go way back. We go back to the late 60s.
Did you perform in the circuit together or something?
A bit, yeah. We actually met in Aspen, and he was working someplace, and I was working someplace. And I remember he was a book collector, and I was a book collector. And there's this beautiful, rare book called The Expert at the Card Table by S.W. Erdnes. And it was published, I think, in 1907. And it was one of the early books that exposed ways to cheat at cards. And, of course, the author, if he had been known, would have been beaten up. And S.W. Erdnes is Andrews, written backwards. And that was the real author. And we both sort of fought over a copy of that book once.
Who won?
I bought it, and then I gave it to him.
Oh, you're so generous.
Years later. Yeah.
Do you remember the point in your career when people started to realize he's smart? You know, because you played kind of stupid, you know, wacky personas, right? And then eventually people realize, God, he's really smart.
Well, you know, it's not something you can never say about yourself and believe it.
Right.
Is that you're smart? And so I don't, you know, I don't think of myself as smart. I don't know. I mean, I almost feel like if anybody thinks that they're being cheated, because I also know people who actually are really smart, and I've been around them. You know what I am? If anything, I'm diligent. And but I've been around people who are smart, and I feel like my relationship to them is my dog's relationship to me.
Your dog's a good audience, let's not forget.
Yeah. Well, my dog, he gets, you know, if I say, go get the tennis ball, he knows to get the tennis ball. But if I say, go get the tennis ball and take it upstairs and put it under the bed, then he's at the point of duh. And I find that happening to me when I'm around really, really smart people, that there's a ceiling I hit of understanding.
And you know, when you're very funny on stage and on screen, as you are, people expect that you're just going to be, you know, a laugh riot when you speak in person too. And did you have to deal with the expectation that you were just going to be, you know, a real cut up in person?
Well, I guess a little bit, but sometimes I can be a cut up. You know.
No, I realize that.
Yeah, and you know, it's really people who don't know you who expect that, and I don't really find myself in those circumstances that much anymore. At least in private circumstances, I'm a pretty regular, sociable person, or a social person. So, I couldn't do in private what I did on stage. People would not want to be around me. If I'm that hyper all the time, and I've kind of worked it out now. Kind of figured out how to be.
Well, you had the responsibility of having to be funny at the Academy Awards when you were hosting right after the start of the war in Iraq.
Right.
How did you work through in your mind how to handle that?
I'll tell you. It goes back. I was working in 1963. I was working at a theater doing comedy show at Knott's Berry Farm, California. And that day, Kennedy was assassinated. And everyone was stunned and shocked. And, of course, we weren't going to go on. And then the owner said, we're going to do the show anyway. And we just couldn't believe it. We didn't even know how we'd get through it. Well, to my surprise, I said, this is going to be the worst show ever. To my surprise, the audience was riotous that they wanted to laugh or something took hold of all of us. And this memory of this tragic day stuck in my head. And I knew somehow that this could be overcome once the show started. And all I needed to do was to acknowledge in some way with exactly the right tone, and then get on with it. And it was a tough day because I remember just before the show began, I just turned on the news for 3 minutes and turned it immediately off because it was one of the worst news days for our troops. And I just didn't want to be infected or know until later. And we went on. And did some acknowledgments and then went through with the show. And I really did feel at one point, I think one of the writers, I had some great writers with me, said, they will be watching, meaning the soldiers will be watching. And that's when I thought, if I were they, I'd like to see a good, funny show.
Mm-hmm. So how did you decide what your opening line should be? Because that's the real icebreaker.
Oh, that was a line about, I looked around at the, Oscar set, which is always, really overblown. And I think I said something about, well, I'm glad they cut back on all the glitz. And, it was just that simple little release. And then I just went on with the show. Just something you think of and seems like the appropriate moment. It's not hilariously funny or anything, but it sort of gets you over that hump.
What kind of guidelines are you given about, not taking a stand or saying anything too political?
None.
Oh, really? Because it sounded like the actors were told not to be overtly political.
I think actually I don't recall what happened, but I was given no instruction at all.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I said and did was determined solely by me.
Any thoughts on Michael Moore's speech?
Well, we knew he was going to say something if he won. And so we were, it was actually Dave Barry, who the great syndicated columnist who deigned to help me write some things along with some other great writers. And he said, I know Michael Moore, he's gonna say something because we saw him at this other thing and he was this way and he's going to say something, we should have something. But we didn't really come up with the line. Then he did his diatribe, which is, that's what Michael Moore does. the audience response was mixed. They were booing a lot of them. And if they were booing, I think it was because of the inappropriateness maybe at that moment. Not that they disagreed or agreed. I couldn't tell. I think the line we had was, came out afterwards. I said, oh, it was so sweet backstage. I wish you could have seen it. The Teamsters were helping Michael Moore get into the trunk of his limo.
So you had that one ready to go?
No, we didn't have it ready to go. We had it after the fact, and we were watching, and then we had a team of writers, and it just spontaneously occurred in the room, and that's what we went out with, or I went out with.
Listen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Steve Martin, his new novel is called The Pleasure of My Company. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the rhetoric of colorblindness. This is Fresh Air. The language of racial classification can seem so complicated and inconsistent that some people have suggested we simply throw the classifications overboard. That's the goal of a proposition on tomorrow's California ballot. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg says you may as well try to pass a law to rid the language of irregular verbs.
The recall has been getting all the ink, but the item on tomorrow's California ballot that has the most important national implications is what backers call the Racial Privacy Initiative, which sharply restricts the state's ability to classify people according to race. Opponents of the measure argue that it will hamper efforts to gather information on discrimination, hate crimes, and health questions. But supporters defend it with a new rhetoric of colorblindness. They ridicule the stew of ethnic and racial classifications that students have to tick off on University of California admissions forms. As they put it, it's time to junk a 17th century racial classification system that has no place in 21st century America. Well, they're not going to get a lot of argument on that. But the classification system they want to sweep away is more of a modern creation than an ancient one. And if the language of racial classification seems inconsistent and jumbled, that's the fault of the uneven social landscape we're asking it to map. Those inconsistencies came to the surface in a recent story about a 15-year-old high school freshman in Oakley, California, who had gathered 250 signatures to start a Caucasian club. If African Americans, Latinos, and Asians could have clubs to teach them their culture, as she put it, then why shouldn't whites have one as well? That logic was plausible to a lot of people, including 87% of the respondents to a poll conducted by a Los Angeles TV station. Others thought the club was a bad idea, though a lot of them blamed the multiculturalist for setting a bad example. As the National Review's Jay Nordlinger put it, a Caucasian club, ugh, enough of the balkanization of America. Actually, the key word there is ugh. There's something about the history of that quaint word Caucasian that makes even conservatives a little squeamish about seeing it in an organization's bylaws. As it happens, the word is exactly as old as the American nation. It was invented in 1776 by the German anthropologist Johannes Blumenbach. He chose Caucasian in the belief that the white race began its peregrinations when Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat in the Caucasus. By all rights, the Caucasian label should have vanished a long time ago, along with Mongoloid, Negroid, American, and the other categories of discredited racial theories. One reason why it survived is that it was often used in what were called the Caucasian clauses of organizations and restrictive housing covenants. But even then, the word wasn't used in its anthropological meaning, where it included the peoples of the Middle East and North Africa. It was simply a genteel-sounding way of excluding people of the wrong sort, whoever they happened to be at the time. As late as 1947, a civil rights report said that there was no immediate prospect of a mass migration of Negroes, Jews, and other minorities into exclusively Caucasian areas. And when Jews were reclassified as Caucasians soon after that, it had more to do with their effects on property values than with any new findings in physical anthropology. In fact, the Caucasian label has become even more common in recent years, to the point where it's part of the active vocabulary of a high school freshman. That's partly a response to the need for a term to pair with African American, another odd entry in the American racial lexicon. When African American was popularized in the late 80s, it was supposed to suggest an identity defined by ancestry rather than by color. But we don't use African American the way we use labels like Italian American, where we feel free to drop the American part when the context makes it clear. We talk about an Italian neighborhood, but not an African one. The African of African American isn't a geographical label, it's just a prefix that means black. If we were being consistent, we'd contrast African American with European American. But the only people who use that term are scholars and the modern racialists who have tricked out their programs in the language of multiculturalism. A couple of years ago, an outfit called the European American Issues Forum persuaded the California legislature to proclaim a European American Heritage Month. Instead of European American, people use Caucasian, which seems to invest European descent with an objective scientific standing. That's specious, of course. If African American is a racial category masquerading as a cultural one, Caucasian is a cultural category in racial drag. But it can be a useful word to have around when you want to make a racial contrast without risking a charge of vulgar bias. And its scientific-sounding cachet made it the natural choice for the name of a high school club. To white adolescents in the California suburbs, the old ethnic identifications are remote and attenuated. And mere whiteness is apt to strike them as boring. As that California student put it on CNN, well, you ask the kids, what are you? They'll say white, but white, that's not a race. Actually, she had that backwards. It's white that's the race and Caucasian that's the cultural category. But her confusion was just an outgrowth of the language of race itself. We're always struggling to find racial labels that answer the question, what are you, with even-handed essences. But the labels keep catching their sleeves on disparities in the way we think about race itself. Racial classifications are like irregular verbs. They may be inconsistent, but they run too deep to eliminate by decree.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com, and from Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with syndicated columnist Molly Ivins about her new book, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. She lives in Texas and covered his years as governor. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.